You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm back for another Friday. Today, my show, I hope, will be very interesting for a lot of people. I've been getting slews of emails about a new movie that is being watched by, I think, millions, probably, or it will attain that kind of audience very soon. And I started getting emails to the effect that this was a very dangerous movie, full of disinformation. And I thought, huh? Now, I hadn't watched it yet. I did know the person who made the movie, and I sent him some of these emails saying, this is what people are saying about your film. What do you think? And he wrote back and said, well, yes, people say things like this, they're misunderstanding what it's all about. So I invited this very interesting filmmaker on my show to talk about his new work. Should I reveal the title or not? I think I should. I think it's killing everyone to have to sit on the edge of their chair. But the film that has just come out is called Zeitgeist Addendum, and it is a follow-up to the first Zeitgeist, which took the world by storm. And that was kind of a sprawling work, Zeitgeist 1. It covered several different topics and caused people to react quite violently to its part 1, which was about organized religion and the origins of our leaders, Jesus, I suppose we could say. There were many other, Sumerian, Hindu, all these religions had typical characters in the seat of a guru that were all born around the same time of year. And thus, Peter, who created that film, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But he did rather a brave and innovative thing by pointing all this out. Peter, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Sophia. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm rambling along here, but your Zeitgeist Addendum has picked up with a thread that I think was already in Zeitgeist 1, but you've expanded it and polished it and offered something very interesting with this creation. What would you like to say about Zeitgeist 1, just to clue people into how you made it and then how it led to this? We're going to have our break very soon, unfortunately, but
okay.
Sorry.
Okay, well, I'll try to be brief. The first film essentially, you know, dealt with all of these, what I consider to be myths in the social consciousness, and delves into things that people think are true and have been taught are true, and essentially goes into conditioning in a behind-the-scenes type of manner. The film was really kind of speaking to the fact that we've been told so many things, and because we've been told these things, we believe them. So the conditioning aspect was a very important kind of revelation that led to the sequel, Zeitgeist Addendum. And as I believe you've seen it, I go into much detail about conditioning and how this relates to society. Now, the first film, you know, was very much addressing the problems, as far as I could see it, very important mythological...
Okay, we're into our break, Peter, okay. And we'll pick up in 3 minutes.
Sure.
You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Peter Joseph, who has just shown the world the Zeitgeist Addendum film, which is causing all kinds of waves. And I wanted to just remind people of the meaning of Zeitgeist. Peter was telling us that the first film, Zeitgeist, was addressing mainly the problems, I assume, that we are experiencing today. And the definition in my dictionary of Zeitgeist is the general intellectual, moral, and cultural climate of an era. So, Peter, would you like to carry on?
Sure. I was saying before the break that the first film dealt with the problems and it focused on mythology to the extent, not just religious mythology, which is a classical definition of mythology, but cultural mythology, this sort of, you know, this false zeitgeist, if I could put it in a phrase like that, that's been presented to the public, and the public has blindly kind of gone through and supported ideologies that are associated with certain establishment systems, whether it's religion or government. So there's this propensity in the systems for people to be, in society itself, to be paralyzed by this identity association with the dominant philosophies and worldviews that are prevalent in the system that basically constitute what you would consider normal. You know, at the very beginning of Zeitgeist, I have a saying by Krishnamurti, which is, it is no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And I believe that our society is extremely sick. And it's not just these groups that, you know, have dominance, that continue to exploit and manipulate, you know, from 9/11 to the Catholic Church. It's much more profound, and it goes much deeper than that. So the first film, you know, attempted to discuss these things in a, you know, in its trilogy kind of format. The first section was about religion, specifically Christianity, because that was the most historically relevant as far as the documentation and relationship to the other deities, because of the composite nature of the Bible itself. Then it jumps ahead to 9/11, which is essentially a pure myth, and the reason that our society believes what the government tells us, at least the majority still seems to believe it, at least on some level. Granted, I think a lot of people have woken up to it, which is great. Even people that I would never suspect, you know, have gained certain suspicions about the use of it, you know, the pro bono aspect of this thing, or excuse me, the cubono ass thing, who actually gained something from this. There's all sorts of angles you can look at, not to mention the obvious evidence against the official story. And that's a pure myth, and people don't want to accept the possibility of what the evidence details because it shatters their identities with the structure that they want to identify with, known as the United States government or society itself and our leaders. So, and then the third part, of course, goes into the banking system and these, you know, these highly, highly powerful groups and individuals and personas that have thrown their weight around for this, for their own self-interest in a very greed-based way. And this, is, of course, is prevalent today. In the second film, I continue where that picked up. I go into the monetary system in much detail because, unfortunately, most people in our culture in the West, probably throughout the world, are very much confused about how money works, what it is, how it comes into existence. And essentially, the policies by which it's governed do not cater to the well-being of people. And this is what I discovered, and I find that, and this is a central theme throughout Zeitgeist Addendum, that the monetary system presents a behavioral tendency. It because of the way the game is rigged, and I mean not just rigged from this sort of capitalist bailout socialism that you have going on right now with all the banking failures, and they're rigging it to save, you know, their little cartel and their affiliates and friends, but it's also a scam on a much deeper level because it's perverting human behavior due to the need to survive. We have to engage this system, and I'll go into this in more detail as we keep moving forward, but the main theme of Zeitgeist Addendum is that the profit system itself has led to extremely detrimental worldviews and despotic behavioral patterns in society from, you know, from the poor to the rich. It doesn't matter. It's a corrupt system in and of itself based on the very nature and structure of it. And all of us in humanity are forced to be corrupt due to it on some level. Of course, we don't recognize that because, again, as I said before, it's considered normality to, say, manipulate and get one up and to, you know, to advertise and manipulate to the extent that you try to lure people in to buy something. The entire world chisels off each other in this system, and that's why I have this centralized theme. And then I present an alternative that I discovered, which I think is incredibly profound, even if you don't agree with this group that I have in the film called The Venus Project, and so holistically, you still begin to see the kernels of truth and points, the incredible points made by men like Jacques Fresco, who have studied, you know, monetary systems and studied social design and social engineering from a professional standpoint. And I found it to be extremely revealing. At least it opens people's minds, even if they don't agree with it, because I know there's a lot of fear out there when it comes to social systems. You know, the original terrorist was, in fact, a communist. And, you know, you say anything to somebody about, you know, the world working together as opposed to competing, they say, oh, you're a communist, because that's their only association. That's all they know. That is what they've been taught, and they can't see outside of that. Sort of like an Eskimo who's lived, you know, in the Antarctica for his entire life, and he's never seen a book or a film, and so he has no idea what a palm tree is. someone could try to describe it to them, but it can't be relatable because it's not within the experience. And this is the brainwashing of the zeitgeist that we currently live in. We have a completely brainwashed society. I would say, you have to have a brainwashed society in this system for it to work. And that's why the system is completely false and why people are so upset and why you have so many people on pharmaceutical drugs, you have so many people going to psychiatrists. The whole system is inherently sick, and I believe that the first thing we have to address is the monetary system, not only from its criminal elements, but from the actual mechanisms that make this system work at its very core, and what that means for the awareness and social, what that means for the behavioral patterns of humans in order to operate to survive. So I hope that encompasses it to a certain degree for you.
Well, yeah, that's a great introduction. I'm curious to know, when you started to suspect the monetary system, you used the word, you said it forces all of us to be corrupt, and that kind of made me sit up, because most of us would not construe ourselves as corrupt. I mean, I'm sure that people in certain levels of businesses know that they're playing a dirty game, but the average person, how are they, that's my first question to you, how is the average person corrupted, truly corrupted, in the meaning of that, the true meaning of that word?
Okay.
And then the second question is, when did you start to notice that there was something wrong with this world we live in because it's dominated by the exchange of money?
Sure. Well, okay, as far as the corruption, basically we've created this illusion in society that there's a winner and a loser. From the moment that you're in school, for example, you know, which is educational system across the world is exceptionally primitive. You know, they have, you give a kid, you know, say he has a better cognitive ability than somebody else, and the kid gets an A. So someone who can read, say, I don't know, a book and retain it, you know, to a high degree on one reading, the kid gets an A, and then someone else who might have a more of a challenged disposition to the effect where they don't have the same neurotransmitter arrangement, you know, people don't think scientifically like this, they get an F if they don't do well. They get a whatever. They get a lower grade. And this sets up instant stratification of this sort of competition win-lose type mechanism. And this carries throughout the entire social system as based on the monetary structure all the way to, say, sports. And the very foundation of it is simple, win and lose. Now, to think that you can fail at something is a total misconstrued notion philosophically. There's no such thing as failure. Only within a context that describes it is failure actually real. Only a context that recognizes some type of, you know, disparate separation can this exist. Obviously, to fail at something is completely ridiculous because everyone's in a process of emergent growth. Therefore, there's no such thing as failure. You're always going to have, you know, multiple steps forward and a few steps back. That's how it's always been and how it always will be as far as learning. And we always have to change and adapt. So the competitive notion of winning is completely distorted. We have, you know, professional sports. I mean, how many people do you know go to a baseball game and they look at, and they, you know, they root for whoever's winning based on the performance? No. Everyone goes and roots for their team because they have an identity association. This is no different than patriotism. It's no different than branding and people walking around with Tommy Hilfiger logos on their shirt. Little do they know they're just walking advertisements for the corporation, yet they've associated an identity with this, and this causes a colossal distortion. So what happens is you have this colossal us-against-them mentality, and religion, of course, exploits this like crazy. The entire disposition of religion is an us-against-them element. I mean, you can go into the philosophical teachings of the Christ character and see different variations of this, you know, as far as not being that way. In other words, you know, there was certain very positive quotes that existed with the Christ character that were very, you know, very very Greek, actually, in their orientation and their origination. But then you go, you know, in the Old Testament, it's all about us and them and fear and hate. And then you go, of course, the Quran, the same type of thing. So the entire thing is based on an us and against them mentality. And I've had interviews with other radio talk show hosts that refuse to, you know, acknowledge these things. They think that human society has to be a competitive situation. What they don't realize, and of course they say it's human nature, what they don't realize is that it's the environment that dictates these types of attributes. So what you have, say for example, you look at a lion in the wild, a cub of lions, naturally they have social hierarchy and they have competition and violence because they have to in order to survive. The reason that they do is not because of some innate, you know, instinct. It's because the environment dictates their behavior. And this is a very important point that I'll go into more in a little while. It's the environment that dictates what our behavioral patterns really are. So when I say that people are corrupt, it means that they're in a system that forces them to behave in a certain way that would be considered offensive and aberrant to somebody else. So So if you go into a job interview and you're there in a line of other people that want the job too, your basis is to beat them for the job, which makes you inherently corrupt because you're not respecting the well-being of somebody else because it's based on the assumption that there's a winner and a loser. And this type of thing is expanded to unbelievable degrees. You know, we have people that in extreme wealth that are looked upon as high social achievements because they have all this money. We think of status as money, but yet it's that for someone to have outrageous amounts of money is also inherently corrupt because, A, they're forced
to... We're entering our next break, Peter. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm talking to Peter Joseph, creator of the new film Zeitgeist Addendum. Peter, we were just discussing how the competitive nature of our society corrupts people in their very sort of basic behavior and orientation to each other. It's like, you use this analogy in your film, The Game Musical Chairs, which was my all-time most unfavorite game at birthday parties as a child. I just thought it was a horrible, adrenaline-creating, awful ordeal, and I was often the one without the chair, because I just didn't want to hurt myself trying to sit down in these lousy chairs that split all over and all the children scrambling and screaming, and the parents watching, like, this was a great thing, you know?
Sure.
So we have, I think, this competitiveness that is instilled in us that is supposed to be a good thing, and you have described that as actually the root of a twisted way of interacting in our society with each other.
Sure. Yeah, I think the I think it's outmoded at this point. You see, it's inherently corrupt to be competitive because of what competitive is an open element. There's no rules to any of these games. So to work against somebody for your own gain, for example, we can jump straight into, well, actually industry is a classic example. Industry, anybody who runs a job, who runs a company, is forced into a general form of corruption because they have to be in order to maintain the competitive edge. And this can range from, you know, firing somebody because of, you know, they get a new machine to do something, which, well, it might not seem corrupt. It actually is because you're injuring that person's well-being. Or just, you know, outsourcing all these jobs to another country and for, you know, slave labor, which is done perpetually by the fashion industry. So not only is it corrupt that they're exploiting poor people for gain, they're also corrupt on the other level that they're removing jobs from the local communities. You know, this is, it's an endless cycle, and it's all a general matter of degree. I don't see much difference in the general corruption that you see in industry and then the Iraq War. To me, they're all the same thread, and I think it stretches up even to, you know, even massive corruption, such as political assassinations, things like in Zeitgeist Addendum I present with John Perkins, where they murder leaders that do not cooperate with the corporate interests of the West, and he goes on and discusses this incredibly profound position of globalism and how it's actually used to maintain, you know, corporate interest. Money is, you know, the old adage, money is the root of all evil, has an incredible amount of validity. It's not the money itself, of course. It's not even the policies itself. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the game of musical chairs. This is absolutely true on multiple levels, and the example of the movie I use is derived from the fractional reserve process, which further compounds this competitive nature because in our money supply, there's not enough money to go around. And there never has been in this system. And, you know, you can have people that try to do other sorts of monetary reform, and that might help certain things, which I agree. I think people should do monetary reform. I think we should get rid of interest. You know, the very fact that the game is set up to the reality that you can have $1 million and put it into a savings account and make 5% interest or $50,000 a year, and you do absolutely nothing. that is corrupt, and that further compounds the stratification. You have people in the lower classes that are paying 18% interest on their credit cards, and you have people in the high classes that do absolutely nothing, and they're making, you know, outrageous amounts of money through interest just because they have a lot of money to begin with. This whole thing is perpetuates the stratification of our society on multiple levels. And then, of course, the very foundation of the competitive structure that we live in worldwide, there's no difference between socialism or communism or capitalism on this base level, because everyone has to work, has to compete for labor or compete for clients or compete to maintain market share, and then they have to have labor for income, and then income has to be used to get resources. And this pattern is so controllable by people at the top, apart from its general corruption, that it's unsustainable on multiple levels. And the world you see is essentially the result, I think, of this more than anything else. You know, we have a subculture of people that really believe, and it's a religiously derived notion, that there's a whole group of people, you know, sitting on a mountaintop somewhere around a round table that are making all the decisions for the world. And to a certain effect, in the financial realm, this is relatively true. But the true danger, jumping a little bit, is that it's the people that have to wake up and realize what they're a part of. Because once the people at the top lose their control of the masses, then the house of cards will collapse. And I think it's an important distinction to realize. So I don't really care for targeting the high business elites and the corrupt, you know, establishment per se. I'm not interested in going after individual people. I want to see a change of the environment and a change of the awareness of the culture, because that's really what's going to bring true lasting change. And as I present with Jacques Fresco and the Venus Project, he presents a social system that makes so much sense and presents, it's just so advanced that most people, of course, can't realize it, can't think about it because they're not used to it. But I think once people start to learn about the underlying philosophy, it will really shatter that fictional zeitgeist that people believe is true. And to answer your real question from the before the break, again, your other question before the break, how did I discover this? Well, you basically, as I grew up, you know, I'm thinking to myself, why am I a slave in this system? Why can't I do what I want to do? I have lots of interests I don't need money for. I have lots of creative interests. I love to do lots of things. Why can't I do this? Well, you can't, because the social system forces you into slavery based on a predefined set. So you're basically robbed from cradle to grave, and you're shoved into a specialized field, and then you have to be a slave in this system.
We are in our break again, and we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
True.
You're listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking today with Peter Joseph, creator most recently of Zeitgeist Addendum. Peter, we were saying before the break, you were saying that one is ushered into this life where one is robbed from cradle to grave, having to exist among others, competing for space, job, money. And your words were about yourself that you had many interests. Why couldn't you just pursue them? But it seems that we are hurled into having to participate in this debt-based world, and that we're told from all sides, no, 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 you can't just pursue interests. You have to owe. Hurry. You have to begin right now. So what happened as you became aware of the, I suppose one could say that there's a craziness, or it's inverted. There's a fallacy to the whole thing, you know, that you can feel it. I felt the same thing as I was entering my teens and early 20s.
Yeah. Well, one thing I will say that when you're born into the system, you think it's normal. For example, most people think that, you know, this kind of labor system that we have in the government system that we have, that this is the way it is, and it's the highest, you know, level of our awareness or our society at that point in time. And they consider it normality, and then they're given words like free, like everyone in America thinks they're free. And I don't mean, when I say, you know, I think how the illusion of freedom is profound, and when I say that, I don't mean just because of the Patriot Act and all of these obvious things that have been imposed upon the culture to preserve the establishment. I mean the fact that if you think you're free in this system where you have to punch a time clock and walk into a private dictatorship for 40 hours a week just because you need this to survive, then the notion of freedom is blown out the window. Freedom is about as much of an illusion, in a word, in this system as democracy is. People think we live in a democracy. Well, there never was a democracy in America, and there's no democracy that exists anywhere on the planet because of the very rules of the game allow certain people to get in the forefront of the media, get forefront of the public consensus, and to manipulate the variables for their own interests, primarily derived from money. Not to mention the obvious, you know, it's much more corrupt now than it ever was, but nevertheless, you know, all of these are false words that make no sense. Same with the free enterprise. The free enterprise system is claimed, you know, by Adam Smith that if you have everyone competing for self-interest, some invisible hand will guide everything and it'll work out for the betterment of humanity as a whole. Well, if that was the case, then why do we have so much regulation in association with, you know, monopolies and corporate corruption? There's so many laws in the books to try and regulate these institutions. Why? Because it isn't a real system. It's a completely false system. There's no reason that if they let the free market actually work, you'd have the biggest monopoly dictatorship, and you already do have this, but it would be much more transparent, that the world has ever seen, because all it takes is groupism to compete with each other and gain differential advantage in resources, such as Walmart, for example. You know, Walmart is this massive, massive institution that, when it moves into a neighborhood, all the little jobs are shut down. It exploits third world labor constantly. Yet this is the free market capitalism at work. This is a classic example. The bailouts of the market, this is the free market. People say, oh, if we can just have the free market and it'll work, let's just make sure it, you know, regulate it correctly so the free market really does work. That's a total illusion. Because free market or monetarism, which is essentially the entire world system, is based on competition, therefore differential advantage. Therefore, people will bend their so-called ethics or morality to whatever degree they need to maintain their competitive edge or their survival. And this can't work. So you have to have a different system. So I was thinking about these things, and, you know, just as I said, you know, why can't everyone has something to contribute to society if they were given a chance? This whole idea of work and leisure, for example, is a total contrivance. The only reason that you have leisure is because people hate their jobs, because they're forced into them. So you have, you know, people say, well, if people didn't have, you know, if they weren't required to work, they say, then they would just sit around and do nothing because they relate to this leisure association of people being lazy. Well, we don't know that. There's nothing to say that that's true whatsoever. I think people, if they were given the opportunity, like a child, to do what their genuine interests were and their genuine education and creativity allows them to grow with, then people would contribute to society of their own nature, and the human value system would shift. And this is something we can talk about more as we get into the ideas of the Venus Project. But yes, back to my original point, we exist in a completely slave-based system. It's just presented to us as freedom. It's given a different name. And the other thing that reveals this real fast is the fact that what do you do if you're a secretary at a law firm? What are you really contributing to society? If you're answering phones for some, you know, company to take orders, are you really contributing something to the world at large? I mean, it'd be different if everyone's role had something real to contribute. I mean, advertising is one of the biggest industries in America, which produces absolutely nothing. The richest man in the world, supposedly the richest man, Warren Buffett, who's worth, I don't even know how many tens of billions of dollars, but nevertheless, he has done nothing but gamble his way into wealth. He's taken money and just made money off of it. He's produced nothing to contribute to society in any real way. We have people that make $3 million a year playing basketball, yet we have people that are in the fields of science trying to find cures for AIDS that make $30,000 a year. The whole thing is completely backwards and distorted from top to bottom and inside and out, and it's time people start thinking about this and wake up to the system itself, because as far as I'm concerned, things like 9/11, you know, the hegemonic rule, the empires, the constant wars, the genocide, the poverty, the disease epidemics will never, ever change unless we address the actual social design of the system itself, because I think they all emerge out of it.
Now, Peter, do you think the social design is something that is organically formed, it just evolved out of us as a species, or do you think it's an engineering?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think there's a certain natural, I mean, I think the monetary system is a natural culmination because we came out of scarcity, just like our relatives in the animal kingdom. The difference between a human being a pack of lions, is that the lions don't have the mental capacity to create traps. They can't, you know, they can't do things that are essentially invent things, use creativity to help them ease the problems of their lives. We as human beings can, but since we've come out of this scarcity, just like all of our other relatives in the animal kingdom, we have these conditioned tendencies that keep perpetuating themselves because of the need for survival based on this assumption of scarcity. So there is an organic aspect to it, and of course when you get into the monetary system, the fractional reserve system, whoever came up with the fractional reserve system knew exactly what they were doing. There's no way it was just some big mistake. They knew it was a Ponzi scheme. They knew it was a pyramid scheme. They knew they were going to have these booms and busts. So they created the Federal Reserve, and the states came to be. And, the Fed is there as a lender of last resort to make sure that the fractional reserve system keeps going. They have the ultimate ability to so-called bail out or just funnel outrageous amounts of fake money to banks that are failing because of this system, because they have more outstanding loans and they have the requirements. And, of course, it's all ledger line stuff if you look into it. It's all just a massive scam. So, yes, that is completely contrived. But the monetary system itself does have a validity. We needed early on, we needed positions of exchange on some level. We needed something because we still lived in scarcity. Deep down, the only reason money exists is because of the need to regulate scarcity.
Well, let me ask you about this word scarcity. When you say a lion, the lion world, kingdom, whatever you want to call it, has problems, what's the problem that the entities in the lion world have?
Okay. The problem, or any, basically, it's not really a problem in its natural state. But the fact is, my point was, when you look at the wild kingdoms, people try to convince themselves that humanity is the way it is because of a genetic impulse that could be related to the animal kingdom. So a lion, for example, has to fight. It has predators.
No, a lion is an apex predator. It's like the great white shark. It really doesn't have a lot of enemies.
Okay, well, it still has its own lions to deal with within the actual herd. Say if they kill a deer, they have to fight with each other very often for food. I'm using a lion as a general example. You can look at any other group of animals that behave this way. They exist within scarcity because they have to fight and have hierarchy and dominance in order to keep everything in some type of workable system for it to work out. The scarcity environment produces this type of behavioral pattern that's needed. So they, when they kill something, they have to hoard it and fend off the foxes and fend off everything else on some level in order to maintain their sustenance and survive. So, you could use another example. A lion, of course, is an apex animal, obviously, but it has its own predators, too, and depending on what its environment is. So the very basic point is it has to do with scarcity. The lion can't create something that can capture food so it can hang out with its family and do what it wants to. Obviously, I'm idealizing this and personifying it. It's not that cut and dry. But the difference is we as human beings are very different because we can separate and we can create and ease the stress of general elements of life that used to be very difficult. A caveman didn't have tools. He had to do all sorts of things within his scarcity age. It's the period of time because he didn't have the ability to ease the situation to the extent where he was not forced into fighting with other groups and dominance and territorialism because of the need to survive. Today we live in an entirely new paradigm.
Well, it seems to me that animals in the natural world are really, this is my view, so you may disagree, and that's just fine, but I have to state this because I'm trying to work something out here. I don't believe animals in the natural world are operating in scarcity at all. They have a kind of balance, and whether they are hierarchic and they establish an alpha leader or not, it has to do with maintaining their own balance in their group. And it's usually pretty, it works. Wolves, for instance, will just pick another alpha. If the beta will become the alpha. I read this wonderful book about wolves. And I would assume that lions and these other carnivorous species have similar hierarchic formation. However, I think that humans have not found a way to be in accord with this natural world that we're in. And the whole concept of scarcity is an engineered concept in our lives. And it's a deliberate engineering so that we can form into competitive divisions and not be able ever to achieve that kind of organic regulation that animals manage to so easily without having to think. And because we are maladapted, we don't have what it naturally takes to be okay here. We're not fast. We don't have claws. All we have is the brain and the thumb, and we're bipedal, and that has given us the advantages. Now, you could say that we evolved like that or there was some other creation. But anyway, I think that we operate in scarcity, and the natural world doesn't. That's the point I'm making.
I can relate to that. There's tons of contrived scarcity in our society, absolutely. The monetary system, as pointed out, is inherently scarce. The industry creates scarcity because it wants to, because that's how you preserve market share. No one wants an abundance in this system because you can't make money off of an abundance. The difference, though, is that scarcity, I mean, on a very fundamental level. What is considered an aberrant behavior of, you know, a pack of, say, you run into a bear, and the bear decides it wants to eat you. To our perspective, you know, and this, of course, happens, and to our perspective, you know, the bear is being an act of aggression towards another organism and has to take that life in order to survive. But if the bear lived in an environment where it was presented and it was reconditioned, as it say in a zoo or something, I'm just being general here, it lived in an abundance where its food was presented to it and it didn't have to go out and kill it. This is the mechanism I'm referring to. This is that competitive element. I agree that nature sort of balances out in many ways, and there is a survival of the fittest element there as well, but nevertheless, scarcity is a reality in the animal kingdom on just the most basic level because it's not readily available. And when we go into the Venus Project, I can say more about this. What we have is the ability in our human society, we have the understanding and the technological know-how to produce a complete abundance, that no one could ever even fathom, but our system paralyzes this and decides to continue the scarcity. It is artificial, as you stated. It's completely artificial now, but it has a basis, you know, as far as our behavioral patterns are concerned, with nature itself. So that's the point I'm trying to make, and I agree with you, but the scarcity at its fundamental level is the animal kingdom doesn't have things provided for it in the sense that it can't create systems that will relieve it of certain problems. Just like early primitive man had to go out and hunt as opposed to just walking into a grocery store. So that's the relationship I'm trying to make. And that behavioral issue is what sticks with us now due to the artificial scarcity. In other words, that competitive need, survival of the fittest, every man for himself, you know, fighting over food, fighting over this and that, fighting for survival, as opposed to working together. This is now a totally artificial disposition. And I think we have to start addressing this in society because that seems to be, in my opinion, the root of a great majority of the psychological problems and sociological problems we have today, everything from, you know, crack dealers to the Iraq War.
Right. So it seems like what you're saying is we are manipulated into this state of needing to be in survival and not seeing how we can create and have created all the pathways to abundance. In your film, you stress that our abundance can be achieved through technology, which I thought was a different way of putting it, and I had to really, like, crank my brain to get around that one because the metaphysical concept of abundance doesn't really have anything to do with technology. And there's actually a difference that I came to realize some months ago between luxury and abundance. It's stated on the back of Handbook for a New Paradigm. Humans were intended to live in abundance, not in luxury. And what we've done in our society is substitute the concept of luxury for abundance. Yes, it's nice to have a car rather than have to take the bus. This all means abundance. And in your film, abundance is introduced as a consequence of having technological know-how, meaning abundance as freeing yourself from having to survive into having enough time to exist, because we are trapped in the survival mode. And I believe that's artificially created, and that abundance, in my definition, is about opportunity. We are never not provided opportunities to get out of this. It's just that we cannot recognize them because so entrapped are we in the equation which we introduced at the beginning of this discussion. You've got to jump into the debt-based sinkhole and start to owe right away.
Right.
So I thought that the power of your film was that it used terms that metaphysical people use, but it used them in more, shall we say, what's the word? There's a word. It begins with C. Contemporary wave, right?
Okay. Sure.
Okay, so we're hearing the break music again. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Peter Joseph, creator of the new film, Zeitgeist Addendum. Peter, right before the break, I saw in my notes, by the way, I took 7 pages of notes on your film.
Oh, great.
All in horrible handwriting. Hard for me to read now. But you mentioned in the film another thing that I thought it did really ingeniously was to put terms to things that I've never heard before. Maybe it reflects my having my head in a barrel, but the idea of resource-based economy versus debt or monetary economy. And once again, I'm going to cast an even bigger meaning on the word resource. Resource means creativity. You have resources at hand that you don't even know you have because you've been trained not to see in that way. But in your film, resource-based economy, I think, refers to the natural richness of the earth itself.
Yeah? Yes, fundamentally, but I completely agree with you as far as your notion of resources and human creativity. I think that's part of it, too, actually, when you look at the design that is being presented.
Now, this, you have another term, the emergent nature of reality being fluid. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. In the fourth part, I present the emergent and symbiotic elements of natural law, these insights, I think, that people should think about. As far as the emergence, it's really very simple. If we look at history, we recognize that we're always in a state of constant change, and we are always going to surpass what we've done before. And therefore, it presents a certain philosophical disposition, I think, that is very counter to the way most people operate today and definitely the established institutions. For example, most people, as I stated earlier, their identities are associated with a static notion because they think to be vulnerable or to change or to be wrong is a sign of weakness or failure. And this is one of these things that we have to get past because when we recognize that everything in society, everything in nature, everything in civilization, everything in the universe is emergent and constantly moving, constantly expanding and changing on some level from the Industrial Revolution to the modern age, you know, from hunters and gatherers. You know, we have moved forward. We have technology today that would be magic to people that lived, you know, thousands of years ago. What the pattern shows is that everything's constantly changing. So everything that we think now, as I state in the film, there's no such thing as a smart person. It's only a matter of degree based on the environmental conditioning of that period of time. So it's these insights of the emergent and symbiotic nature, I'll talk about the symbiotic as well, that I think if people really understood, and when I started thinking about these things, it changed me profoundly. I don't, for example, like as far as my behavior is concerned, recognizing the emergent nature of reality, I try as best as I can, even though the society doesn't reward it very well, to be as open as possible. So even when I get emails that are extremely out there, and I initially read it and I have a knee-jerk reaction, like, oh, this is, I can tell where this is going, I'll still try to follow through and absorb it with the most objective disposition I can possibly have as a person, and really try to take in everything and always allow myself to change and welcome that type of change, welcome being wrong. I think I mentioned before when we discussed privately that I believe that a belief system can only be valid if, and it seems paradoxical, but if that belief system has built into it...
Peter, we're at the top of the hour break. This is a very short one.
Okay.
So please bear with us.
I'll come back to that.